Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis Reardon for Petitioner Bishop in this 2254 habeas corpus proceeding. Given the requirement of AEDPA that in order to gain relief on a federal habeas petition, the petitioner must demonstrate either that the state court unreasonably applied federal constitutional principles or acted contrary to clearly established federal law as interpreted by the Supreme Court, certainly in my experience, relief is granted only in those cases where a federal court is left with the firm conviction that something has gone fundamentally wrong in the state proceeding. And let me begin perhaps at the back end of that equation then. Something did go terribly wrong here, and the state court acknowledged it. Gail Bishop, a fairly controversial elected public official, given her anti-development stance in Contra Costa County, was prosecuted by a political opponent after that political opponent, Gary Yancey, admitted that both he and his entire office was disqualified ethically from this prosecution. The state court found the means by which District Attorney Yancey and his deputy, James Sepulveda, continued to prosecute the case to verdict after disqualifying their entire office to be a charade that raised serious questions about the fairness of these proceedings. The state court, however, felt that it could not reach that unfairness because a motion to disqualify Sepulveda and the office had not been made prior to verdict. And we submit that it is the very failure to make that motion to disqualify that enables this court to not only grant, but that it must grant relief, because it is that failure which satisfies the adverse effect test of the conflict of interest standard.
Now, just to be clear, you have not brought a separate Strickland claim as to that failure.
Not in this federal habeas corpus proceeding, Your Honor.
And what is the state of the record on this? I mean, in fact, we have no idea whether this had anything to do with why, whether the conflict that we're going to get into now had anything to do with why this wasn't raised.
Right. And under Kyler, what we know is this, and the state court said this, defense counsel said they were going to bring this motion to disqualify. That's in the record. It's a factual finding by the state court. We know after saying they would do it, they did not. Is it reasonable? Is it a step that competent counsel would normally take to disqualify a prosecutor who has admitted his bias? Certainly it is reasonable. The difference between the state court and our position here is that the state court used the Strickland standard. It said, okay, certainly they could have moved to disqualify him. It was a charade. Frankly, it deeply disturbs us. But you haven't proven that prejudice. You have not proved that the failure.
Yes, but it's not the prejudice. You haven't proven the effect. You haven't proven that the reason they didn't do it was for that reason.
But under this court's authority, Your Honor, how does one prove that if you have
an evidentiary hearing and you ask them? You have an evidentiary hearing and you ask them, is the reason why didn't you do this? Is the reason why you didn't do this because you had this conflict?
Your Honor, I
would do it without having to prove prejudice from their not having done it. In other words, what you don't have to do, if it's Kyler rather than Strickland, is demonstrate that who the lawyer was, for example, had anything to do with how the trial came out. That's irrelevant if you can prove that the reason why they did this was because of their conflict. But isn't there a huge evidentiary gap here at this point?
No, Your Honor. I submit, Your Honor, that if you look at this Court's authority and virtually any authority, there has never been an evidentiary hearing that question. Look at Lockhart. Look at Ms. Kinnis. In each of those cases, look at Sanders versus Rattell.
But isn't this – we just did a remand in a similar case for a purpose that seems very much like that. Earp versus Arnasky? Is that the right one? I think so.
I'm not sure of that,
Your Honor. It was a recent case, and that may be it, in which there was a remand, essentially, for an evidentiary hearing on a question like that.
But in these cases, Your Honor, Sanders, Ms. Kennis, Lockhart, what the Court said was, is it likely? Is it a likely result? And how do you figure out whether it's likely? You look at whether competent counsel ordinarily very well might not have done, may have done something like this. I have never seen a conflict case, Your Honor, which was resolved on the basis that counsel came in and said, oh, by the way, the reason I didn't cross-examine was because I suffered from a conflict.
Lockhart was pre-Mickens, right? Lockhart was pre-Mickens, before Mickens.
I believe that's true, Your Honor.
And I'm just wondering whether or not after Mickens this likely standard survives, or whether all the emphasis in Mickens about proving an actual effect meant you have to prove an actual effect, not a likely effect or a possible effect.
Well,
not prejudice, but that something happened as a result.
Your Honor, Mickens, actually that was not the holding in Mickens. Mickens was a case in which they essentially said that that you have to prove an adverse effect. But in Lockhart, in Ms. Kennis, what they looked at and was the fact that counsel had not done something that counsel would ordinarily do. I don't know that there is any the problem with examining counsel with a conflict about why they do things is that's why we have conflict-free counsel, because it's virtually impossible then to know what their motivations were in a given situation such as this. We've got a disqualified prosecutor bringing charges that indisputably are marginal. The prosecutor's closing argument is if there's as much as a dollar misspent on each of these five felony counts, this defendant is guilty of five felonies. There is no public official in the state of California that does not commit a felony every day under that standard. The reason we demand conflict-free counsel, especially in political cases, is to ensure that marginal cases are not being brought for political motivation rather than because of a dispassionate considerations of the merits of the case.
The case I had in mind is Alberti versus McDaniel, which was August 9th, 2006, and which did remand because the reason why something was done was not necessarily attributable to a conflict. A link between deficient performance and the conflict of interest must be shown, and then they remanded for an evidentiary hearing. What is the state of the evidentiary hearing in this case? I mean, what is the state? Would that be a viable alternative here, or are we sort of beyond that at this juncture?
Well, the difficulty, you know, that we would have is that it isn't whether there was a tactical purpose. I mean, in an incompetency case, you say, did counsel have a tactical reason to do or not do something? If there's a reason...
I just want to know if they did it. That's all. Is this why you did it? And this particular instance in which you're suggesting that there was essentially a deal cut, that shouldn't be that difficult. It's not sort of internal processes. It's... You know, did you cut a deal?
No, Your Honor. In a conflict, if an attorney has a conflict and in this situation is being told that we may kick you off the case and you have a right to kick us off the case and nobody makes this motion, how do you sort through that? An evidentiary hearing in which counsel says, was there a tactical reason to do this? Very often, there's two good alternatives open to any counsel. The reason that we demand conflict-free counsel is being free of a conflict is the only way we can be sure that the conflict doesn't operate here. These are lawyers who were told by this judge, you are not to talk to your client about this. You are to protect the interest of a major prosecution witness. The court created a conflict
well,
by that
order. Well, one problem is, of course, that's not what the court said. He said to one lawyer that you're not to talk to your client about this, not to both lawyers.
Well, he said to one attorney that you are not to talk to your other attorney about how to prepare this witness. They couldn't talk to one another. And when he lifted the order, he said, I'm going to assume that you're going to continue to act just the way you've been acting before this order has been imposed. So, in effect, the order was never lifted at all. And we are so how do we sort through that? The McInnes case, I submit to Your Honor that if you have a factual finding that a lawyer is going to do something, and by the state court. They've announced their intention, and they don't do it, and they suffer from a conflict. And that conflict is certainly related to the other counsel's conflict, because both of them have raised these conflicting or warring conflict claims.
But in this instance, there was a very good reason not to do it, wasn't there? In this instance, there was a very good reason not to do it.
Which not to do?
Not to challenge the person, because if they challenged him, then they'd have him as a witness.
Well, that arguably, well, actually, Your Honor, that isn't true, because they had the worst of all situations. He functioned as a witness in this case. He gets up in closing argument and talks about his personal experience. He should have been disqualified for that reason alone. What competent counsel allows a district attorney to get up and give a closing argument about events that the district attorney was part of? It's worse. If he was a witness, they would have gotten a chance to cross-examine him. Instead, he gets up to give his version of events in closing argument, not subject to cross-examination.
I've noticed that there have been several Contra Costa County cases like this. I sometimes wonder if there was only one lawyer in Contra Costa County, because everybody seems to show up with all these weird interreactions. But anyway,
The problem with conflicting counsel is that it's impossible to sort through their motivations because
right.
they've got a
so
conflict.
So here's another legal question. Where are we at this point after Mickens with regard to whether there is clearly established law that Kyler applies at all to successive conflicts? Or you're also arguing, as I understand it, that the order itself created a conflict. Right?
Yeah, I am not – this case, we are not making our argument to this Court on the successive conflict basis. Imagine if a completely unconflicted counsel gets up to examine a witness who he doesn't have successive representation with. The examination starts to get close to areas where the witness might incriminate himself, and the judge says, "Counsel, I am imposing upon you a duty as an attorney to respect, you know, witness A's Fifth Amendment rights. So conduct your cross-examination aggressively, but you have an ethical duty to protect him so he doesn't incriminate himself." Does that order create the most blatant conflict imaginable? Absolutely.
All right. So let's assume so. It's not exactly parallel here because this was not a trial. It was before trial, and it was one lawyer, not two. But leaving all that aside, Mickens has this section at the end which says, this is just to tell you that we haven't really held anything about Kyler outside of the direct representation of two conflicting defendants.
Right. And the Second Circuit says this case, the Bishop case, and in Tueros, which we cite in our brief, both of those cases were tried before Mickens under Kyler. The notion that the dicta in Mickens could say anything that changes Kyler is unsustainable.
But our case law seems to, again, be heading in the opposite direction, does it not?
There is no case, Your Honor, there is no case that would suggest that you don't have a conflict if you have divided loyalties. Let's say these counsel had not represented Ms. Arcedo before. Let's say they hadn't, but the court, for whatever reason, had the sense that she had these matters, these very embarrassing matters, and he said to counsel, "Look, I want you to protect the witness's interest in confidentiality as much as your client's." That's a conflict created that has nothing to do with prior representation. This court issued an order to a law firm saying divide your loyalties, okay? You're a law firm. It's Burek and Berg. You both have the same ethical obligations because you're partners as to Ms. Arcedo, who is a former client of Mr. Berg. Honor those obligations and represent your client.
Oh, but that isn't exactly what he said. As I understand it, the order went beyond the ethical obligations because the ethical obligation and may well have created a conflict for the person as to whom it was issued, who was Burr, because it did go beyond the ethical obligations because it required that he not say anything about having anything to do with his representation Arcedo, presumably including things that were of public record and not confidential
exactly.
at all. But that order, the one that went beyond the public or the ethical obligation, didn't apply to the partner.
But in a law firm, the ethical obligations are the same.
Yes, if it's an ethical obligation. That's what I'm saying. But the he was issuing an order that went beyond the ethical
right.
obligations, and he was issuing it only as to one of them.
Right.
So is there only one of them who had an obligation, who had a conflict due to the order as opposed to due to whatever the ethical obligations were?
And to not assist his law partner in any way to find out the things that he might find out that would be helpful to their respective client. You know, just another aspect of this, of course, that the court has to confront is that to the extent that we move away from the conflict analysis and say this didn't create a conflict, we have for the first time apparently in the history of United States criminal jurisprudence a gag order that not only lasts overnight, that lasts for months, when the United States Supreme Court has approved a gag order in one context and one context only, a break in the cross-examination of the defendant. The government is asking this court to say that there are no constitutional implications on the Sixth Amendment right to counsel if a court imposes a gag order on a defense attorney not to talk to their client, when the Supreme Court certainly has said the opposite, and no court has said this. The government says, oh, no, if the order is some reasonable, if there's a reason for it, then, you know, there's no problem with imposing gag orders on clients. And I would submit that no federal court in the United States can take that position.
Clearly, if there were one lawyer, this would be a major problem. There were two lawyers. What difference does that make?
If they are of the same law firm, And the gag order is on
I
your...
I don't understand that. The gag order didn't run to both of them. It only ran to one of them.
But any lawyer in the state of California, certainly, and in the nation, knows that if your law firm has a conflict, the entire...
complaint is that the order ran beyond the conflict. If it didn't run beyond the conflict, then it was a perfectly good order. The problem with it was that it ran beyond the conflict.
Well, no. If it just ran
to the conflict,
it wasn't a good order if it ran just to the conflict, Your Honor. That's the problem with conflicts. You can't solve them. If you protect Mr. Arcedo,
I'm not saying it was. I'm saying that's a different issue. But you're trying to say that it's the order that created the conflict, not the conflict, right? So if it's the order that created the conflict, it's because it went beyond the conflict, which it did. It did go beyond the conflict, but it only ran to one of the lawyers.
But the order that was imposed was saying, look, a member of your law firm has a duty, and I impose on that member of the law firm a duty to respect that. He has to respect it by not assisting his co-counsel in the conducting of this criminal trial that they're conducting together. I submit, Your Honor, that having done that, you have placed the law firm under an ethical obligation to treat the confidences of the look at the prophylactic effect. I mean, in this situation, after this order, if Burak had done what he didn't do, which is attack the credibility of the witness on the basis of this prior criminal prosecution, would he fear that he's then subject to even civil suit on the grounds that he's violated
prior criminal prosecution? I thought there were some civil contempt orders.
I stand corrected. It was civil. There was an underlying criminal charge of a kidnapping involved in a divorce case, Your Honor.
Which was dropped, and presumably would never have made proper.
And documents indicating that there had been false statements made to the court within that context. Ultimately, Your Honor, if you uphold the order, if you say that it's a constitutionally acceptable order, I just don't think you can do that. So the question is, let's say it is unacceptable constitutionally, but the court is raising a multitude of questions about how the prejudice might have affected the case. Then we're dealing with the fact, and Perry versus Leak says it, Getter says it, if the gag order is unconstitutional, that is the end of the matter. It is reversible per se. Why? Because the Second Circuit in the I believe, no, it was not Tueros. It's cited in our brief, made the point. There was an overnight order. Maybe it was rescinded before the weekend. And the court said, look, we can't get into this kind of speculation about what difference it might have made. You cannot issue gag orders on counsel other than in the context of proven Perry versus Leak. If you do, that's the end of the matter. I mean, how do we sort through that? I mean, how can you ever sort through that? I've got 20 seconds left. Let me
try. Reserve your time. We'll give you a minute.
Let me try and preserve it.
Good morning. May it please the Court. It's interesting that the recusal issue keeps coming up because counsel specifically informed the appellate court that he was not raising this issue in his new trial motion, on appeal, or on habeas in the state courts.
And he never directly raised it. He's raising it now, as I understand as evidence of what may have been an actual effect of the conflict or the direct conflict or the order conflict.
Well, I think my point is, Your Honor, that appellant was represented in a new trial motion. A number of issues were raised, including the conflict issue. Counsel had an opportunity at that time to raise the Strickland issue or this factual question and did not do so. The appellate court also found, I think it was the concurring judge, found that, in fact, the trial attorneys were cooperative with appellate counsel, and there's no indication otherwise. With regard to the Burak being burdened by the gag order, it's interesting that this issue changed in the appellate court as well. Initially, the issue was raised as Berg was not given an opportunity or didn't have an opportunity to discuss this matter with co-counsel. After oral argument, I understand, in the Court of Appeal on a subsequent habeas, the issue turned into Burke was misled by Berg about the nature of the contempt proceedings. And I think that this is clearly laid out in the record in the concurring opinion. That's at ER 107, 108. But clearly, and the trial court in the new trial motion and the appellate court found that Burek not only had the opportunity to investigate this stuff about the family matters, the contempt, he did so. And, in fact, that these matters were public record. And, of course,
how do we know that Burak did investigate it?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Where in the record do we know that Burak did investigate it?
Well, I believe at SER 2, at our excerpts, if this is the new trial motion, the court is addressing this issue and discusses this evidence was investigated as by Burek. And in Burek's declaration in support of a supplemental habeas corpus, Berg declares that he discussed this matter with Burek and there was some misunderstanding about what actually happened with the civil contempt proceedings. And that's also discussed.
Well, there were criminal contempt proceedings.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
There were criminal contempt proceedings.
Well, but they were dropped, Your Honor, and the state court specifically found that this was not evidence that would have been admissible to impeach anyway.
Well, this may be because it was too old and a lot of other factors that might not have been admissible, but...
But it was because it wasn't criminal, Your Honor. That's discussed in detail in both the lead opinion, the majority opinion, and the concurring opinion. It's because these were civil matters that they weren't admissible, in part.
Well, they were over 10 years old in the
release. Yes, Your Honor. And counsel, in any event, Burke certainly had an opportunity to investigate this, and well before trial, a gag order was rescinded.
But did he investigate other things? In a case like this, the natural thing would be to put an investigator on this very important witness and find out everything that he could.
I believe that he did, Your Honor.
Where do we find that?
Well, the principal impeachment was that Mrs. Arceto was actually fired from this.
Well, I understand that, but that was very clear. But is there anything in the record that tells us what kind of an investigation was undertaken?
As to other, I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
Appellate counsel suggests that he uncovered some impeaching evidence. But again, there was no, this was never developed. No Strickland claim was made at any time in the new trial motion or at any time thereafter. The gag order was imposed to basically preserve the status quo because Arceto hired an attorney who came in and said that he was going to file a motion to recuse Berg. And so to preserve this, the witness's rights, the court entered into this gag order, which was then rescinded after.
Well, counsel disputes that. He says it wasn't actually rescinded because the judge said, well, I'm rescinding the order, but you should do the same thing.
Well, but that's not true. I think Your Honor pointed out there's a difference between a judge saying, don't talk to your counsel about this issue, to be ethical.
And I understand, but as I understand the representation that was made before, is he said one, not two. He said the former, not the latter. Is that so? He didn't say just be ethical. He said something. He said do the same thing I told you to do.
You know, I have the quote here somewhere, Your Honor, and I don't think that that's the case. It was discussed in the Court of Appeal opinion. This is the Court of Appeal's decision, comments. The court's remarks to the effect that Berg would operate under the same guidelines would have applied if the order had never been imposed and did not serve as a cloud over Berg's participation in the trial, but simply voiced the ethical obligation imposed upon the attorneys to respect the confidence.
Well, that's sort of the obverse.
Excuse me.
That's kind of the obverse. Are you going to address the question of reliance on the advice given to her by the prosecutor, entrapment by estoppel issue?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I have that. There were some other claims I was going to get to. But basically, the problem with counsel's argument is that, first of all, the appellant misled the district attorney. She hid the evidence that she was using.
Well, that's an element of the entrapment by estoppel. But the question is, why wasn't the instruction given? And then the jury could have decided what he thought about that.
Because estoppel didn't apply. And estoppel didn't apply because.
But that's deciding the defense. I mean, if somebody raises a defense and says, yes, I did tell him everything, then you have to have a jury determination of whether you told him everything.
Well, Your Honor, there has to be substantial evidence to apply to instruct on it. And there is no substantial.
Well, there was a letter. There was her testimony as to what Sepulveda had told her. There was her testimony as to what she had told him. On her story, why couldn't she have succeeded if you believed her story?
Well, no, because the letter from the district attorney just said there was no evidence that appellant staff has assisted in her law out practice because appellant covered up that evidence, and also some assistance might have been provided on personal time. That letter did not, as
right,
the Court of Appeal.
But she testified beyond that he told her specific things. The most direct one being that reimbursement did matter. And then he stood up and took this firm position at trial that reimbursement did not matter. And the court eventually concluded that he was right. Reimbursement didn't matter. But still, she had a testimony about what she was told, which was to the contrary.
Well, but the Court of Appeal found, as a matter of fact, that there was no evidence that she made substantial reimbursement. They said the absence of quantified reimbursement in the present case demonstrates it's not what happened here. And it's at ER 59. The Court of Appeal.
There was evidence that she said that she hadn't put in for a certain cost that she could mileage and various things and set that off against the use that she made of the fax machine and so forth. So there was evidence.
Well, Your Honor, there was not substantial evidence. So the Court of Appeal found that as to counts 3, 5, and 7, there was no claim of reimbursement at all. And that her comments.
Well, that's fine. So she would have lost that
okay.
Could have not gone to that. But as to some of the counts.
She made general allegations of I didn't claim money for mileage, but the Court of Appeal found that was not substantial evidence of reimbursement. And, of course, in any event, reimbursement is not a defense in this case. Appellant seems to concede that. So basically what we have here, and the instruction request was based, I believe, on the letter that was sent to the complaining citizen, which was then CC'd or a copy was given to appellant. But again, that letter specifically stated that I found no evidence that that appellant is misusing state funds or requiring her staff to work for personal, private reasons.
Maybe it's just my confusion. The prosecutor who summed up, right, was one to whom this conversation presumably occurred. I mean,
Your Honor,
I realize I'm looking at the brief for the appellant. This does not even raise as an issue. But maybe as an outsider, how could it be that they allowed him to try this case? Was that you? I don't know.
No, no, Your Honor, it was not. I think this was basically an agreement by all the parties. The Court of Appeal rejected this issue, which has not been raised on habeas.
I understand, but I just, as an outsider, I just have a lot of trouble understanding how you could agree to that, how any court would accept it.
Your Honor, I cannot answer that question.
Okay.
Except that, Your Honor, as the trial court found in denying the new trial motion and the Court of Appeal found, appellant knew about this and went into this with her eyes open, and she had tactical reasons for not wanting this district attorney as a
witness.
As a witness. And it is true that the Court of Appeal said that this recusal appears to be a charade. However, the Court of Appeal also found that the issue was not, couldn't be raised because it would allow the appellant to play fast and loose with the system.
Well, why should, to go back to the counsel question and the effect of all this, why shouldn't there be an evidentiary hearing on the question of whether, in fact, the reason why this issue wasn't raised was because of the order and or the conflict of counsel, not prejudice, but just why didn't you do it? No one's ever asked that question, have they?
Well,
have anybody ever asked the lawyers why they didn't?
Well, first, I have two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, appellate counsel had an ample opportunity to pursue this issue and chose not to.
No, not directly. I'm talking about through the window of the conflict gag order question, i.e., what was the effect of the he's suggesting that the actual effect of the conflict and created by the gag order was not to challenge the prosecutor.
The court,
and the question is, why shouldn't we find out whether that's true or not?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, it's entirely speculative, Your Honor.
I don't know. Secondly, that's why I'm asking why we shouldn't find out.
Well, because it was never – they had an opportunity to address this, to raise this, and it was not raised.
The implication of what you're saying is he agreed in order that he doesn't lose a fee and lose the client and he won't go after him. I mean, is that what we're talking about?
Well, that's the suggestion. That's what's thrown out there, but never – they never made any attempt to prove that. And the gag order was removed.
But you're suggesting a waiver? In other words, the problem is they haven't asked for an evidentiary hearing. Is that the problem?
Your Honor, this is an issue. I think that, frankly, it's a red herring. I think that, frankly, the reason we didn't have an evidentiary hearing and there were no declarations on this issue, because there were declarations from counsel on other issues, trial counsel, is that they don't really want to present it that way. They wanted to be able to argue it. And I think looking at,
well,
at this situation realistically.
But just from the point of view, I'd like to know why, from the point of view of the court being asked to resolve the question as opposed to the tactics of the lawyer, are there procedural reasons why we could not issue ask for an evidentiary hearing because it's been waived or not exhausted or something like that? Or is there any reason in the sort of structure of the case law why it wouldn't be appropriate to do that?
Well, Your Honor, because firstly, they have not established a conflict. They have not established a conflict which applied a trial or any critical court.
You don't think that the order itself created a conflict for the lawyer to whom it applied?
Not that constitutionally affected their rights, Your Honor, because they were dual counsel, one of which had an ample opportunity, in fact, I believe, did investigate
because
this.
Of the two lawyers. But if there had been one lawyer, I mean, your brief doesn't acknowledge this, but clearly if there had been one lawyer.
That's true. And if that gag order had not been rescinded. And it's interesting, Your Honor, in that regard.
You mean that it would be okay to tell one lawyer that he can't talk to his client before trial about a critical witness?
It was just a temporary order to preserve this witness's
rights. A temporary order for months and months, wasn't it?
Counsel.
Go ahead. Your Honor, it, first of all, oh, I'm sorry.
I think there was conflict, and the only question is the consequences of that conflict. So, you know, the conflict is right there, but whether or not it's had an adverse effect is another issue. I want you to address the issue of the jury, having this county employee on the jury.
Well, I think the comment by the county employee was just that it's tough to be a county employee because the budget's tight. I don't think that's outside information.
There's an affidavit that from one of the jurors that he was asked to talk with them about the integrity and the honesty of county employees and what the whole process was in the county.
But he didn't, Your Honor. I think my understanding is that he did not, that the only thing he talked about was how tough it was to work with a budget. If I may, before I run out of time, I'd just like to point out counsel relies on Jones v. Vasco, which says that he alleges says that rescinding a gag order doesn't save the issue, the conflict. But Vasco suggested that rescinding the gag order would have. What Vasco determined, or Jones v. Vasco, is that the evidence did not show the judge rescinded the gag order. Not that rescinding a gag order doesn't cure this conflict. And, Your Honor, to return to the question of dual counsel, I don't think that the court would have engaged in this procedure had there not been two attorneys. I don't think that this would have happened. I don't think that the court probably would have lifted the order earlier, and certainly given that the order was lifted before trial and the only alleged prejudice is some non-existent impeachment that's 10 years old, that there is absolutely no need to look into this other issue.
I have another question. What about there was no COA issued on the sufficiency of the evidence question as to two perjury charges. But the second one, count 10, troubles me. I don't understand how there could be sufficiency of the evidence on the question of whether she directed somebody to do something when the state court specifically said she didn't direct them, that did not, in fact, direct anybody to do that. It was just what they understood.
Your Honor, I have to apologize. I did not prepare.
All right. Well, obviously, you'll get a chance to brief it if we do anything with it. But if I'm headed in the wrong direction, I thought it would be helpful to know it now. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In the future, you should be prepared on that, because when we have something in the briefs like that, the question isn't the merits, but the question is whether a COA should issue on it. That's fairly raised.
In the future, I will, Your Honor.
Okay.
Unless the court has any other questions, I'd just like to sum up by pointing out that this is a situation that the trial court and the court of appeal and all of the parties and the declarations, as far as we can tell, knew very well what was going on with the recusal issue, and it was not litigated and not raised, and there was a tactical reason. They didn't want this attorney to testify in this case. And unless the court has any other questions, I'm willing to submit it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Quickly, Your Honors. The recusal issue was clearly raised in state court in the new trial motion and on appeal. The court of appeal.
Which recusal?
The issue that this was an unfair trial because the prosecutor was ethically disqualified was raised in at the new trial motion and on appeal. The state court said we won't deal with it because the trial counts and the issue of this incredible fact of the prosecutor arguing about conversations that he was part of to the jury in closing argument. The response to the state court to all of that was and let me direct myself to that. The response of the state court was we can't deal with that because your trial attorney didn't object to it. So the reason all of these things are folded in here is we are asserting that the reason there wasn't an objection was, and the prosecutor just...
You didn't bring a Strickland motion and charge and or claim, and we don't have any record about why this didn't happen.
Well,
so instead you're relying on what might have been, what might have happened.
But, Your Honor, the government just conceded. They stood here, and in response to Judge Traeger's question, how could this prosecutor?
We have no record. You could read it also as a whipsawing, by the defense counsel. It's another way of the record could be read. That he was playing a very clever game. You know, he would try to be in the case, and then, of course, if the judge knocked him out, then she'd have a, you know, deprivation of a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. I mean, we don't have the record, but I got to tell you, the whole thing doesn't seem right to me. It's not before
us. It isn't right, Your Honor, and the response to your question was there was an agreement. That is just the point. The government just said there was
I don't know how you can fold I don't see how that impacts on what on the issue that is raised before us.
Well,
I guess that's my problem.
The issue that is raised is that counsel said they were going to challenge this district attorney's office. They didn't. The state has now said it was because an agreement was made that this would go on. It was raised. Quite frankly, none of the parties at trial here, including the trial judge, who issued an order, and the government just said he issued the order to preserve the witness's rights, a gag order to preserve the witness. If that isn't a conflict, if the state can't concede that if you issue an order.
I'm trying to fold two issues that to me, just pass in the night. I don't see any connection, really. I mean, it's a nice effort, but.
Well, let me just sum up and then make one other point, Your Honor. It is simply this. The court has looked at this and said, my God, I've never seen anything like it. Why did it happen? And I submit that this record suggests that the reason it happened was because the prosecutor said, I'm going to kick you off the case. The defense lawyer said, I'm going to kick you off the case. And then they reached an agreement that they wouldn't keep, it was too much trouble. And the person who suffered in this was the client who wound up being tried.
Was herself a lawyer and who sat and watched all this and had chosen these two lawyers and knew about the gag order and knew about the prior representation and could have easily fired them and found different lawyers and didn't do it.
Your Honor, I submit to you, and you can judge this yourself, I could ask 99% of the lawyers what the ethical rules on conflict of interest in a criminal case are, and they couldn't answer the question.
Anyway, thank you very much for an interesting argument, both
thank
of you.
You.
An interesting case. The case of United States of Bishop versus Contra Costa Superior Court is submitted, and we'll go to the last case of the day, United States versus Duong.